The best of our knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, from Mexico to Maine, the April 8th solar eclipse will carve a path of darkness across North America. We'll learn how NASA is preparing to study the event. And commercial interest in space is at an all-time high. We'll learn more from the U.S. Office of Space Commerce. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. From Mexico to Maine, the April 8th solar eclipse will carve a path of darkness across North America when the moon passes between the Earth and Sun. Solar eclipses occur about every 18 months, but they're not always visible to everyone on a planet that's mostly covered in ocean. If you miss the 2024 eclipse in the U.S., you may not get another chance until 2044. In addition to creating an unforgettable experience for many, this year's total eclipse, the first to crisscross the U.S. since 2017, presents many opportunities for scientific research. To learn more about the eclipse and how NASA is preparing for the event, I spoke with Anita Day, Strategic Partnerships Manager of Outreach and Engagement for NASA's Science Mission Directorate.
So an eclipse, of course, is when the moon covers the sun and a shadow is cast on the Earth. And some of that shadow creates the path of totality. So in the United States, that will stretch from Texas all the way to Maine. And of course, it'll be in Mexico and a bit of Canada as well. And then there will be a path, or the rest of the United States will be in a partial eclipse. And the further you get from the path of totality, the slightly less eclipse you have. In Maryland, I'll have, I think it's like 86%. So I'll see a crescent sun. And I will be envious of you, you know, those who are seeing the total eclipse. But I'm still looking forward to seeing the partial eclipse, because when else do you get to see, you know, like Cookie Monster has taken a bite out of the sun?
How rare is an eclipse like this in the United States with such a long path of totality that really will span from Texas to Maine?
The frequency of eclipses are a little bit irregular. The last one we had in the United States was in 2017. The next one will be about 20 years from now. And it's all because of the interaction of the orbit of the moon and the Earth, and, you know, day and night, and when is that, you know, chance encounter of the moon covering the sun.
So how has NASA been working, particularly with teachers and classrooms, and helping spread the word and getting teachers to get their students engaged in, you know, something that may not come around again for another couple of decades?
Yeah, we've been working really hard. We have an Office of STEM Engagement that specializes in this work. I work with my colleagues very closely on this. We have a lot of outreach that's going to happen in the days before, just before the eclipse and the day of the eclipse, to classrooms. We have a lot of educational materials that we've produced that students could, that teachers could use with their students. If you go to our website, go.nasa.gov/eclipse2024, you can see everything that we have on offer. Importantly, we also have projects, science projects that people can participate in and actually collect data to help scientists make determinations and discoveries. That includes things for the eclipse. We have the Globe Observer Project. That goes year-round, but they've added a mode for the eclipse where you can record air temperature and clouds during the eclipse. And then there's also eclipse soundscapes, where you record sounds so you can see how wildlife and insects may be behaving differently as the sun is covering up, as the sun is being covered up by the moon.
That opportunity for citizen science in this eclipse is something rather new. I mean, there's been obviously been a lot of observing and research conducted during total eclipses, but in the era of smartphones and in the internet, certainly this is a unique opportunity for a lot of people.
Yeah, the internet really has revolutionized things for us, and smartphones Putting a computer in everybody's hand is pretty special. So most of these projects that I've talked about do let you use your smartphone to make observations. There's another one called Sun Sketchers that allows you to use the camera on your phone in totality to record the shape of the sun, and that will help scientists understand the sun better.
Now, with more high-level research that NASA is doing, what other opportunities for study are there during a total eclipse? Are there any observations specifically of the sun that can be done, or the corona of the sun, during an eclipse that cannot be done at other times of the year?
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. So an eclipse, a total eclipse, covers the face of the sun. So that corona that you mentioned, the outer atmosphere of the sun is revealed to us. You can't see it at any other time. And the corona is really important because it tells us about the sun, but it also tells us about space weather. And space weather affects our satellites, but it also affects us here on Earth. So that's really important. So we have research jets, the WB-57s that are going to fly in totality from Mexico to maximize their time in totality with instruments to examine the corona. We also have projects to learn more about our atmosphere and how it changes when the solar energy is all of a sudden taken away. We have students around the country that are launching a total of 750 balloons, weather balloons, not regular balloons, with equipment to record changes in the atmosphere. And then from Wallops, Virginia, NASA is launching sounding rockets, three of them, just before, during, and after the eclipse to record changes in the atmosphere.
So certainly there's been a lot said about safety in preparing for the event, safely viewing the eclipse itself. What is NASA recommending?
So we recommend you go to a reputable vendor or library or museum and get some solar viewing glasses. They're also referred to as eclipse glasses. They are generally made of paper with a special film to cover your eyes. You cannot look at the eclipse without these glasses. You can look at the eclipse if you're in the path of totality, if the moon is completely covering the sun. But as soon as the sun starts to peek out again, you have to put your glasses back on. The sun is just too bright. There's too much radiation for our eyes. It's very dangerous for us. You can also look at the eclipse using an indirect method. You can use a colander, in your home, and you have a bunch of pinhole cameras right there. You'll see it projecting the shape of the eclipse on the ground. You can do the same thing by putting your hands in a waffle pattern, and putting that near the ground. You can also make a pinhole camera, or you can use the leaves like I did in 2017. I walked out into the courtyard of my office, and the ground was littered with crescent suns. It was the eclipse projected on the ground. It was beautiful.
I saw something similar. I was actually taking a hike that day, and I was by a stream, and I saw the crescent sun dappled throughout the stream. It was really incredible. And there
Impressive.
was a moment where, in the Northeast where I live, it did appear somewhat more dim during the eclipse. It wasn't in totality, but the sun actually did seem to lose some brightness during the eclipse.
Yeah, if you're paying attention, if you know that it's an eclipse happening, you'll notice it.
Now, have you ever seen the eclipse itself, a solar eclipse itself in totality?
I have not. I have not, unfortunately. Maybe in 20 years I will. But this time around, I am looking forward to being at home with my daughter who's six to experience the partial eclipse. And I'm excited that maybe this will open up a new world of possibilities for her. Right now, she says she wants to be a geologist because she likes rocks. I like rocks too. But maybe this will open her eyes to more.
And I think a lot of people may be inspired as well, in addition to your daughter, as to seeing as this may be a jumping off point to a career in geology or science and tech.
Yeah, definitely. I would just like everybody to know that science is for everyone. And this is a great opportunity. The eclipse is extremely accessible. And it's an opportunity either to participate in the science projects that I talked about, GLOBE and eclipse soundscapes and Sun Sketchers, or you just get curious. You observe what's happening to your environment during the eclipse. You ask questions, and that's what science is all about. And you don't need to have a degree to enjoy what science has to offer us.
Well, Anita, thank you so much for taking the time and speaking with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. This was fun.
Anita Day is the Strategic Partnerships Manager of Outreach and Engagement for NASA's Science Mission Directorate. The total solar eclipse, visible in the U.S. from Texas to Maine, will occur on Monday, April 8th. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. This is the best of our knowledge. Commercial interest in space is at an all-time high. More than 50 orbital launches were successfully completed this year, with a launch schedule that's on track to eclipse last year's 211 launches. Private companies are increasingly taking on roles once handled exclusively by the federal government. But whose job is it to provide oversight and guidance in this new age of space exploration? Gabriel Swinney is the Director of Policy, Advocacy, and International Division at the U.S. Office of Space Commerce. Working within the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, the Office of Space Commerce's central mission is to foster economic growth and the development of a U.S.-led global commercial space industry. Swinney spoke with the best of our knowledge's Jody Cowan.
You know, space is by definition beyond any country's borders. So we have laws. We have international laws that set some basic ground rules. There's the Outer Space Treaty from 1967, which is, over 50 years old at this point. And although it certainly envisioned some commercial space activity, I think what we're seeing now is beyond almost anything that the drafters could have envisioned. The good news is that the Outer Space Treaty is really a treaty of principles. So it sets some very high level rules. Like there's one that says you should give due regard to the activities of other actors in space. But now we're having to figure out, well, what does due regard mean? You know, if you're going to send multiple commercial robots to the South Pole of the moon, and they're going to be near each other, and maybe they're going to be looking at space resources there on the moon, what does it mean to give due regard to someone who might be operating 100 meters from you? Or if you're going to land on the moon and kick up a bunch of dust, how close can you do that to someone else so that you don't interfere with their operations? And the same thing for orbits in space. I think people have heard about the debris problem and the congestion problem we have in space, where it's getting increasingly crowded. So we're having to think through, in some ways, space is a limited resource, and humanity has a mixed record of dealing with limited resources, let's say. So now we're recognizing that space, although it extends forever, I suppose functionally, that doesn't mean that it's infinite in terms of how humans can use it. So some of those same age-old problems that we've dealt with on the terrestrial environment, we are now being faced in space as well.
Is it similar to navigating like how an air traffic controller might navigate, planes? Is this how we're kind of looking at ongoing congestive kind of traffic of satellites and kind of different kind of workstations in space currently?
It's a great question. So one thing we're doing in the Office of Space Commerce is taking on what you call a space situational awareness role. Historically, the United States Department of Defense has tracked satellites and other objects like junk and debris in space. They have, of course, lots of radars around the world that were developed really to track intercontinental ballistic missiles during the Cold War, but those same radars can track objects in space like satellites. And DoD has provided as a service to the global community lots of data about where satellites are so that operators can dodge and avoid each other. DoD would prefer to focus on their national security mission. So under the previous presidential administration, a space policy directive, so a directive from the White House came out that directed the Department of Commerce to take on this space situational awareness role from the Department of Defense. So we are in the process of not building out our own radar stations. DoD will continue to operate the sort of hardware, and there's commercial companies that are starting to build out their own systems as well. But what we're doing is figuring out how to integrate all that data that comes from the Department of Defense, comes from the private sector, and then provide a useful basic space situational awareness service to the entire global community. So it's going to be called TRAX. It's our own space situational awareness product. And this year, exactly, we are in the process of rolling out some basic operational services. So that's one way of managing congestion in space is knowledge, frankly. Whether that also translates or turns into air traffic control, space traffic management is what people call it, is a really good question. And I don't think either we in the office or the global space community have an answer for what that's going to look like, because it will have to be inherently international. You know, the United States can't go around telling other countries or other companies based around the world how to operate or maneuver their satellites. So, you know, we're probably not going to be looking at a global or international single controller. That seems unlikely for a lot of reasons, but we will have to figure out how national systems can interoperate and how we can talk amongst countries and frankly, directly amongst operators. So it is a little bit early days. Right now, we're focused on that information sharing and transparency so that operators can make decisions for themselves. But as congestion increases, I think there's a good chance that there's going to need to be at least some rules of the road.
When Intuitive Machines, the commercial company that did their lunar landing, when they did their lunar landing, they had a press conference and was very happy to share their data and share their information and kind of be really fully transparent about their mission and their processes there. Policy-wise, is this something that's required?
This is a really interesting issue, because historically the United States and our government has really led the way in transparency, particularly if you compare the United States to, let's say, other actors like either the Chinese government or Chinese companies. The United States on the government side is incredibly transparent. NASA publishes all of their data online, for example. And that is useful not only for scientists, but very, very useful for safety reasons. You need to know where other actors are, what they're planning, so that you can avoid each other and sort of plan around them. But when you're a private sector company, as my private sector colleagues will remind me all the time, they do have proprietary data. And sometimes the design of a spacecraft or the information they gather is either a trade secret or the data itself is the product. So sometimes if you're a company and you're going and you carry certain instruments on behalf of someone else, the data that those instruments gather, unlike a government science mission from NASA, that data is what you sell. So you don't necessarily want to put that out in the public, because then you're giving away your business. So there are lots of conversations going on about what kinds of information must or should be shared. Those focus on safety. So you're looking at things like location data, maybe some future plans. But what kinds of information don't have to be shared? And that would be those more proprietary or business confidential things, because that is, you know, oftentimes the backbone of the business itself. So it's an interesting topic. You know, what this has come up, for example, in the context of supposed conflicts between satellites and astronomers. Sometimes when satellites are launched, they can reflect sunlight in a way that can interfere with telescopes on the ground, because those flashes of light get picked up by telescopes and can interfere with astronomy. And if you ask some astronomers, they would say, well, just tell us the design of this of the satellite, and then we can understand better what those flashes of light will look like. But those designs of the satellite may well be business proprietary. That's, you know, that's the whole deal is figuring out how to build satellites in an efficient way. So we're trying to figure out, well, what kinds of information should be shared? Maybe not the actual design of the satellite, maybe something like a reflectivity number or a metric. And maybe you can share that and maybe require that level of sharing, but not the actual proprietary data. So that's just an example of the kinds of questions we're working on right now.
What types of companies are currently working with the Office of Space Commerce, and what types of businesses are you hoping to attract in the future?
Well, there's, of course, the companies you've heard about, the big players like SpaceX and Blue Origin, and the legacy players like United Launch Alliance and Boeing and Lockheed Martin. big companies with lots of operations, but there are also tons and tons of startups. I think I meet with probably four or five, if not more, companies every week. And many of these are engineer-led startups with a little bit of a Silicon Valley mindset. People who have a good idea, get some funding, and are trying to make it in the space sector. And that's a really interesting pickle, because these engineering-led startups are, as they should be, focused on operations, focused on their business plan, focused on making the business thrive and work. They don't necessarily have time or resources to think about the broader implications of what they're going to do. So, for example, if you're building, let's say, a robotic spacecraft servicer, a satellite that can go and fix or refuel another satellite, there's a lot of really thorny engineering questions that these companies are focused on. But that has all kinds of policy implications. If you have a satellite that can go and has a robot arm and can approach another satellite and grab it and do things to it, you can imagine other operators, governments or commercial actors even, getting a little nervous about that fact. So, you know, we have to work with these private sector actors to think through, like, okay, what are your capabilities or what could they be? What does that mean for the broader community? And sort of help carry their water, quite frankly, a little bit, because these startups don't, as I say, have the resources to fully engage in the policy process. So part of the office's role really is to understand their needs, understand their goals, and then be able to translate those private sector needs and goals to the rest of the United States government. I spend a lot of time first understanding the private sector and then talking with my government colleagues in other parts of the U.S. government to translate those needs and say, the private sector is hoping to do X. These rules you're considering, or these best practices, or these policies will have implications for the private sector, and we need to make sure we take those into account. So that's one of the most exciting roles, I think, for the Office of Space Commerce is this, we call it the advocacy role, advocating on behalf of the needs of the private sector across the full United States government.
And is space shaping up to be a bit of a billionaire's playground, or can really anybody be a space entrepreneur?
You know, space is expensive. That is the reality, is that a lot of space activities have very high upfront costs, particularly if you actually want to physically go to space. So that does create a little bit of a filter for, let's say, launch manufacturers in particular, or hardware manufacturers. So getting over that, let's say, financing hump has led to substantial influence by billionaires, you know, or other sort of highly financed companies. I think that is changing over time, and that's definitely not the whole story. If you look at the full ecosystem of space actors, you do have the big, let's say, billionaire involved companies like Blue Origin and SpaceX and Amazon. But behind each one of those are dozens, if not hundreds, of much smaller companies that provide subcomponents, that provide the actual satellites that are going to be launched, and of course, that provide the ground services and data analytics. Not every space company builds hardware. A lot of them are really either software or analytics focused, right? Raw data is not particularly useful to the private sector. You need to be able to use that data. Let's say if you want to put a new coffee shop on, you know, in some town in America, just getting pictures of that town is not super useful, but understanding what's the traffic on the different streets and how does that change over time or over seasons? Maybe this is a seasonal kind of place. Maybe it's a beach town. Understanding where you want to put a new coffee shop, that's all analytical information. And there's much lower barriers to entry there. So I think there's a perception that this is a billionaire's playground. There is a little bit of truth to that because space is very expensive if you're on the hardware side, but it is decreasingly so. And for what it's worth, as those billionaire-backed companies succeed and they bring down costs, that then allows smaller companies, new ideas, to leverage those decreased costs and access space. So I think we are, you know, people say we're on the verge of a new space era. I think we're there. We are seeing those costs drop. We are seeing access increase. And even though there's the narrative of billionaire playground, I don't actually think that's true. I actually think to some extent the billionaires are paving the way, but there are many, many other actors that are much more lower profile, and they are very much in space too.
That's fascinating. Thank you for that. looking at NOAA recently released their global climate report, right? Detailing the warmest February on record for the third year in a row now. When looking at how capitalism and industrialization are kind of large drivers to climate change here on Earth, is there caution to be had with the commercialization of space?
Yeah, we're very cognizant of the fact that humanity does not necessarily have the greatest track record for managing shared spaces. We have the ocean as one potential model. We have the global climate as a potential model. Some people talk about Antarctica as an analog for space in some ways. Hopefully, we have learned some lessons over time. We recognize that space is in many ways a limited resource and that none of us benefit from a, let's say, failed orbital environment. So fingers are very much crossed. I think the jury's out in terms of whether humanity can learn those lessons. It's an interesting thing because some people try to draw a direct line from, let's say, the ocean or the environment or Antarctica and say, well, let's just sort of copy paste some of those same rules. I don't think that's appropriate. Space is very unique. You know, if you can kind of keep going forever, which is different, for example, from the ocean, if you go across the ocean, you will eventually hit a piece of land. It's not necessarily the case in space. So it's bigger and you have a lot of interesting physical dynamics because of how orbits work and because of where resources and special locations are. So I don't think copy pasting works, but we really do need to take on board some of the lessons, failures, and successes we've had terrestrially, and hopefully translate those to outer space.
Gabriel Swinney is the Director of Policy Advocacy and International Division at the U.S. Office of Space Commerce. He spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's Jody Cowan. If you'd like to tell the Best of Our Knowledge what you think, send us an email, knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to the Best of Our Knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit wamcpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1749. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Jody Cowan. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.